So, welcome back to the Birdie Bug Pod,
episode 52.
You sure you're ready for this one?
Yeah, I'll be fine. Slightly short notice, but
one that I think was on your list, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's something I've been wanting to talk about for a while, and we did a bird last episode, so it's time to do a bug.
And it is a fascinating bug, actually.
Although, we're using that term very loosely. We're not
say
true
bug, are we?
No. We can go into that.
Okay. So, bit of catch up? You got any catch up?
Not a huge amount. I was quite lucky that a couple of weeks ago for work, I went up to Leicester to do some filming, mainly around sort of river restoration and wetland stuff. But it did mean I got to spend, you know, an afternoon or so behind my camera filming. Didn't do a very, very good job of filming birds. There weren't really very many about, but I got some nice footage of a little frog and some insect species in the wetlands and some dragonflies and damselflies and things like that. So it was just nice to be able to spend a day and a half behind the camera filming wildlife.
So you are basically the next David Attenborough.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that's pretty what much. I'm saying.
Yeah.
But that's it really for my catch up.
Well, I seem to have spent the last week and a half printing out bird pictures and decorating the studio. And
the wall is looking
pretty
incredible.
Banging, isn't it?
Yeah, it's looking lovely.
And of course, you know, starting a little bit of Birdie Bug Pod merch.
Which is very exciting.
We are sitting here with our Birdie Bug Pod coffee mugs, and very posh they are too. And to follow will be T-shirts and all sorts of other paraphernalia.
Yeah, so keep an eye out for some Birdie Bug Pod merch.
Which, of course, we know that you'll all want to buy.
Yeah, but we know everyone's been on the edge of their seats waiting for a T-shirt.
But it might be limited edition and extraordinarily expensive, but there you go.
But it's still an exciting update for the podcast, I think.
So that's about all I've been doing, really.
Which we should really say then, which we will stick this on social media. So if you want to go and see the T-shirts and mugs that you've been playing around with, then head over to our Instagram at the Birdie Bug Pod.
Yes, indeed.
Or do that.
Everyone will want one.
Yeah, go do that social media stuff.
Okay, so I'm going to pass this over to you, actually, but today we are doing dragonflies.
Yeah, we are. I actually had a specific species that I wanted to do an episode on just because I'd seen some news articles about their reintroduction and the fact that it was going quite well, and then realised that they sort of deserve their own episode. So we're talking about them more generally, a little bit of an overview about dragonflies and damselflies as well, sort of their biology, our normal sort of structure. And then we'll talk a little bit about how they're doing in the changing climate, some of the species that are doing very well and some of the species that are sadly not doing particularly well, with obviously the restoration project, which sparked the whole episode idea, because it's a very cool species and it's a nice project as well. And also, it's been a while since we've had an insect focused, like one insect focused episode.
Yes, and then what, again, since doing the research, wow, some of the things that you read about dragonflies are absolutely incredible. Animals been around on the earth for 300 million years, which is 50 million years before the dinosaurs existed. So there's a fact for
you. And they actually predate flowering plants.
Isn't
because they were predatory, or they are predatory. They were about before we had flowering plants.
And they
again,
were a bit bigger, weren't they?
There were some that had wingspans reaching up to about a meter, which... So, I mean, stay tuned. He gets a lot of mentions, but my friend Sean always said if he could go back and see one animal, he'd love to see a dragonfly with a meter-long wingspan, because what an insect that must be.
Well, the theory is that there were very high oxygen levels during that Paleozoic. Paleozoic. I sound like Ross Geller, don't I?
Yeah.
Paleozoic era, which obviously allowed them to grow to a much larger size than they are now. There are 5,000 known species of dragonflies, and they're found on every continent except Antarctica.
Which I feel like each time we do an insect, that is the line, found on every continent apart from Antarctica.
Actually, I think it is, isn't it?
They are just incredibly well spread across the world.
Most are found in the tropics, apparently.
Yes, yeah, they are.
Yeah. And I've got a feeling that I asked you this question in our quiz question on our 50th episode about the Order of Odonata. Because you corrected me, because I think I said Odonata and you said Odonata.
Yeah, because it's Odonates.
I think that was a question in our 50th, what it meant.
Oh, it means tooth.
It means toothed one,
yeah.
If you want to be absolutely precise, and it's Greek for toothed one, which refers to their serrated teeth, although they don't have teeth.
Actually, they have teeth, do they? No, they're like mandibles are quite notched, and so it looks like they're rocking around with a big mouth of teeth, which sort of goes in line with them being very predatory insects.
And they are often confused with damselflies, and you're going to tell me the difference.
Yeah, so both dragonflies and damselflies belong to the order Odonata, which is quite a mouthful.
Odonata, or Odonata.
So dragonflies belong, so that order is then split into Anisoptera. Anisoptera is how I'm going to say it, which is the dragonflies. Typically, not always, but typically larger, stockier. The easiest way to tell the difference, and the one I always fall back on, is that when they're not flying, dragonflies have their wings stretched out horizontally, like an aeroplane, for example, whereas damselflies fold their wings back along their body, so rather than having them sticking out. And I think that's the easiest way to tell the difference. There are other differences about like the position of their eyes and things like that, but in general, just rely on the wings. And then the damselflies belong to the subgroup Zygoptera. And like I say, they typically are a little bit slender, a little bit smaller, and there are some other differences, but just they fold their wings back is the easiest way. Interestingly, we obviously said we're covering dragonflies, but dragonflies and damselflies both belong to the same order. It is normally dragonfly that's used as the collective. People will typically be like, dragonflies and incorporate all of them, but your true Odonate enthusiasts or your entomologists will sort of avoid using that term. Some of them won't even use the term dragonfly and simply call them Anisopterans, which would then be your dragonflies and not damselflies. But I really like the fact that an alternative term that's been proposed is warrior fly, and I think we should be adopting the warrior fly name.
I definitely do. They just look so impressive.
Yeah, they are mighty.
Really are mighty. It's that flight of the dragonfly that really fascinated me, because they are extraordinary in the way that, unlike other flying insects, they beat their wings up and down instead of back and forth motion, but they can move their four wings independently of each other. So they change the movement and rotation of each wing to vary the aerodynamic forces acting on each wing.
Yeah, if you ever
and they
see...
are absolutely extraordinary. I think they are one of the few, if not the only insect that can fly backwards. Is that true?
I know that flies can take off backwards, but yeah. I don't know if they can fly backwards.
Dragonflies can apparently fly backwards, and they do it by angling their bodies vertically at 90 degree angle to the horizon to achieve backward flight. They are extraordinary.
Yeah, I think let's give them that accolade. I don't think flies can do that.
Yeah, and in fact, the flight of the dragonfly is so special that it's inspired engineers who dream of making robots that fly like dragonflies. They're just extraordinary. They are so precise, and they even in windy and unpredictable conditions, because their wings are, like they say, their wings are living structures containing hundreds of sensory neurons, and the neurons provide constant sensory feedback to the brain, allowing the insects to move through turbulence without kind of hitch. They are just extraordinary.
They are phenomenal. I mean, if we can talk a little bit about their basic anatomy, like say two pairs of very strong wings operate independently, but they've also got that typical insect large compound eye.
Yeah.
And if you ever...
Oh, and the eyes are extraordinary as well.
They really do dominate their heads. They have up to 30,000 facets per eye, providing nearly 360 vision, and their ability to detect movement and track prey is absolutely... next to none.
Yeah, apparently they're some of the world's most accurate hunters. And the analogy is, if you think of a lion, they might catch their prey 2 out of 10 times. A dragonfly catches their prey 9 out of 10 times. Yeah. And it's because of that 360 vision.
And their agility
and their incredible agility, yeah.
I mean, actually, a little anecdote. The other day, a friend of the podcast and past guest, Josh and I were out actually looking for adders, but as we were walking through the New Forest, this dragonfly just went straight across us and grabbed a moth out of the air and just disappeared.
Yeah,
and both of us were like, oh, if we could have only got that on camera. And then we realised the odds of us ever catching that in photos is next to none.
Yeah. But do you remember we tried in Croatia?
Yeah, but I mean, as in actually catching.
You remember we tried actually photographing them across the pot of the swimming pool and everything, and it was a job, wasn't it?
It was a real challenge. Their legs form this really cool like basket shape during flight, which is essentially how they just catch their prey. And then, as we've said, they're named after their rather impressive toothy looking mandibles, and they are just full-on predatory insects and will tear apart pretty much any insect that they can get their little feet on.
And of course they start off pretty predatory, don't they, as a larva in the water.
Yes.
You know, the dragonfly nymphs are pretty brutal, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because they eat pretty much anything, tadpoles, mosquitoes, fish, other insect larvae, and even each other. So they are prolific hunters in the water.
Yeah. I mean, life cycle-wise, they go through what's called an incomplete metamorphosis. They're known as hemimetabolous, which means they don't have a pupal stage. So obviously, if you think of something like a caterpillar to butterfly, you've got the caterpillar's larvae, and then they pupate, and then they're a butterfly. Whereas the dragonflies, they're an egg laid normally in water, but sometimes just near water. They then have a nymph or a larval stage, which, as you were saying, are just as predatory as the adults. And they can be several months or even a year as a nymph. They have this really interesting, extendable, hinged lower lip, which basically means they can just catch their prey. Like, one of their favourite things is mosquito larvae, tadpoles, let's say small fish, but it's almost like a grabbing machine, yeah. this extendable lip. And then the adult emerges from that larval skin, so they don't go into a pupal form. The nymph will normally sit above the water on a lily pad or on a bit of foliage, and the adult will literally come out of the back of the thing. It's really interesting to watch. And then the adult will sit there for a while, extending its wings and drying in the sun, and eventually taken off. And as an adult, they only tend to live for a couple of weeks, a couple of months in some species, but comparatively not a huge amount of time. They eat, they mate, they lay eggs, and then they die, like a lot of insects. So,
in all your macro photography, have you ever taken a dragonfly larva, nymph larva photo? Have you ever seen
I've seen the remains of one, so right. I've seen like the shell,
yeah,
and I don't think I've ever photographed them emerging from the nymph. I've watched it happen but not had a camera, yeah. Obviously the nymphs are underwater, so I'd have, yeah, to be sticking my camera sort of,
yeah, I didn't know
water,
if you've ever caught them coming out or like sitting on a, yeah, lily pad or something
only
like that.
Like I've seen, and I don't think I've got a photo of it, but I've seen like the adult sat next to their old nymph,
right,
shell drying off,
right,
but I've not caught the actual moment of them. It takes a while as well of them actually coming out of the shell.
But you've got some good adult dragonfly,
yeah, I've got loads of dragonfly
macro shots, haven't you?
And obviously, so, when, if you go back and listen to our episode from when we were in Croatia,
yeah,
the Krka National Park, I've never seen so many damselflies,
oh, yeah,
in,
yeah,
my
that
life.
Was incredible, wasn't it?
So I've got a lot of photos of them as well. But
I'm disappointed we didn't mention opsins.
All right, opsins.
We're going to throw in some opsins. When we were talking about the eyes, compared to the human perspective, which is based on three types of light-sensing cells called opsins that are sensitive to red, green and blue, a dragonfly's view of the world is powered by 11 to 30 opsins. And this supercharged vision allows them to see ultraviolet colours and polarised light. So that also is another reason why they're incredible hunters. Have such clarity, yeah, of sight and vision.
It would be incredible to be able to see what that...
Yeah,
obviously,
it?
It's not possible. It would be amazing, yeah, to see what that's really...
It
I can't
really
imagine
would.
Existing, being able to just always see ultraviolet light and things like that. That isn't... That's,
yeah,
that's fascinating.
I didn't want to leave out opsins.
You shouldn't. Definitely never leave out opsins. Tell you what, I wasn't going to do this, but I'm going to throw you a little quiz question.
Oh, my goodness. Go
so
on,
we spoke about the prehistoric dragonfly hitting a wingspan of 70 centimeters to a meter,
yeah,
you know, huge,
yeah,
huge insect. Now, the largest living odonate is actually, after we've been talking about dragonflies being the bigger version, the giant Central American helicopter damselfly, which is Megalopripus correlatus. That's how I'm going to say that.
All right.
How big do you think the wingspan of the largest living odonate is? Obviously, the extinct.
What, the largest one now?
Yeah, so still existing. Obviously, prehistoric, 7 centimeters.
I reckon 15 centimeters.
Oh, not bad, 19
Ooh,
centimeters.
I nearly said 20.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say 20.
Oh, I nearly
so
said 20.
19 centimeters, about 7.5 inches, is the largest, yeah, wingspan of odonate still living. So that's pretty
that
good
bad.
Guess. No,
yeah,
I think that's not bad at all. And then I won't do this.
20 would have been better.
Yeah. I won't do this as a quiz question. I'll just throw it as a fact instead. The heaviest living odonates are
It's not going to be 6 kilograms,
no,
is it?
No, it's not. It's going to be... it's the tetra... Oh, bloody hell. I shouldn't swear on the podcast. Tetracathagnia plagiata.
You haven't practiced that?
No,
that's podcast.
That's
it?
Hard.
Yeah.
That's got a wingspan of about 16 centimetres, body length of about... 11.7 centimetres, but they are the heaviest of them, which I've said that and I realised I actually don't have the weight, and the article I read didn't have the weight, but that is, they're obviously a very stocky dragonfly. Its common name, because I couldn't pronounce it, scientific one, is the giant hawker or the giant river hawker.
Okay. But, okay. And they've got some very interesting mating habits, haven't they?
Yeah, they do.
Do you want to describe it? It's very... very complex.
No, you do the mating habits.
It's a very complex and precisely choreographed process, but it's not an exact science, because sometimes if the female doesn't want to consent to mating, she might play dead, for example, or she might wrestle away her suitor by twisting, shaking and flying backwards, or sometimes even she might take control of the flight and dunk the male into a body of water, buying herself time to get away.
That's so, quite funny, isn't it?
Which is quite funny. But they have a really unique and complex, to be honest, I probably have to read it because I can't remember it all. So first the male has to attract the female to his territory, and he has to do that by driving off quite a lot of rival males. And when he's ready to mate, he transfers a packet of sperm from his primary genital opening, which is near the end of his abdomen, to his secondary genitalia at the base of his abdomen. The male then grasps the female by the head with the claspers at the end of his abdomen, and the structure of the claspers varies between species and may help to prevent interspecific mating. The pair then fly in tandem with the male in front, typically perching on a twig or a plant stem. The female then curls her abdomen downwards and forwards under her body to pick up the sperm from the male's secondary genitalia, while the male uses his tail claspers to, I'm not expecting you to follow all this, to grip the female behind the head. This distinctive posture is called the heart or wheel.
Yeah, I have seen that.
Yeah, and that's how they mate. Anyway, it's a very choreographed and very specific way of them entangling themselves transfer this packet of sperm to the female.
It's quite a sight as well when you see them going along conjoined like that.
And apologies for reading it, but I can't remember all that.
I think you did a really good job with it. It's all good. The we spoke, you said at the beginning, there's 5,900-ish species of Odonata. In the UK, we have around 46 species that are sort of regularly recorded, and that's about 25 dragonflies and 17 damselflies. But we do also have species that are occasional migrants and visiting species as well. So that number fluctuates ever so slightly. And I will talk a little bit about the tendency for species to be coming over more frequently and as the climate changes as well.
Okay.
But unless, actually, do you know what I think it's time for? It's time for some cultural impacts.
It is time for some cultural impacts. And I could actually do a whole episode about cultural references to dragonflies, because they've long been symbols in many cultures around the world.
I think you can see why. Something we haven't really mentioned is just the eye-catching colours of them.
Because absolutely.
The damselflies, you get absolutely stunning blues and greens. And then the dragonflies, some of them you've got like yellow and black banded ones. You've got thick red ones. You've got blue and yellow banded dragonflies. They come in some absolutely incredible colours. So you can really see why they would not only have an impact on culture, but art and things
definitely
as well.
Art, artifacts, pottery, rock paintings, statues, jewellery, home furnishings, fabrics. There was a movement called Art Nouveau, which was sort of 1890 to 1910, which was a sort of, they called it an organic movement, where instead of all these symmetrical lines, everything became organic and free-flowing, and dragonflies appeared an awful lot in the decorations of jewellery and fabric. And but they're really ingrained, particularly in Japanese culture, seen as symbols of courage, strength, happiness and victory. And they've got some really funny names going back to particularly English vernacular names. Horse stinger, devil's darning needle, ear cutter, link them with evil or injury. Some Swedish folklore believe that the devil used dragonflies to weigh people's souls. The Norwegian name for dragonflies is eye poker. There's so many. In American folklore, there's a superstition that dragonflies sew up the mouths of liars or those who gossip. But particularly ingrained in Japanese culture, and I found this quite interesting. The dragonfly is a national emblem in Japan, but it also inspired, I hadn't heard of this before, in Japanese literature, poetry called haiku. Have you heard of haiku?
Yeah, I know haiku.
And haiku, is that how it's pronounced? A haiku is a Japanese poetic form typically composed of three lines with a 5-7-5 syllable structure.
Yeah, they became quite popular.
Yeah, often focusing on nature and a moment in time. And I've got a few examples of
it's actually, so I am not haiku. A poet or a poem enthusiast in any regard. I very rarely get poetry. However, haikus are one that I actually really enjoy because, like you said, they're so often based on time and nature. It's something that the samurai used to write as well. And so it's
but they're so short.
Yeah.
And of course it's that 5-7-5 syllable, and you three have to lines.
Really precise with the writing because it's so short.
So I'll give you some examples. Dance, O dragonflies, in your world of the setting sun. That's a haiku. Dyed he is with the colour of autumnal days, O red dragonfly. That's another one. Crimson pepper pod, add two pairs of wings and look. Darting dragonfly.
Oh, that's my favourite one. I really like that. Yeah. That's cool.
Meeting in flight, how wonderfully do the dragonflies glance away from each other.
Oh, that's another nice one as well. Yeah.
So it inspired this Japanese poetry, which I found absolutely fascinating. Among the samurai or warrior class, dragonflies were often favourite emblems for decorating armour and helmets.
I mean, again, the agility and predatory nature, they've got to be a picture
which
of
is what
like
you were saying
sword
about warriors.
Fighting. And, yeah, because they're
absolutely.
Just, again, if you could move with the agility of a dragonfly, you're absolutely golden.
There's so many. There's symbols of protection in indigenous American culture, totems or spirit animals for, again, indigenous Americans, Native Americans. There's a connection between dragonflies and positive energy. There's cultures that associate dragonflies with good luck. Many Christian religions believe that dragonflies symbolized angels.
Also,
I could just go on and on. Dragonflies were associated with certain gods in Egyptian culture, god of the sun, Ra. In Hindu culture, they were associated with god of the wind and goddess of the dawn.
I mean, also shouldn't overlook how popular they are in tattoos as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Hugely popular tattoos, dragonflies and damselflies as well. Again, because they're so, I don't know, stunning to look at, and they're just quite an iconic insect, aren't they? So,
and they even inspired Walt Disney in The Rescuers. Evan Rude is an amazing character that owns the fastest boat in Bayo, and he was a dragonfly. So there, I could go on and on and on. There's been so many cultural references. I could do a whole
maybe
episode.
If you've got some good links for it, we'll stick them. If people are interested in the cultural side of things, we'll stick some of those links in there. So if you want to go and explore this a little bit further, we will make sure those resources are available because it is fascinating. And
it was really fascinating
as the
reading about it.
Person who loves the insects, obviously, I typically say I like to give a bit of love to the animals who are often overlooked, but every now and then you do find groups of insects who have just been so prevalent throughout history and often associated with good things rather than the negative things of, I don't know, spiders or scorpions or thing, you know, those kind of animals. So it's lovely when you see an insect that's had such an impact on culture.
Yeah, definitely. And you say, you know, such an influence. We could go on from there actually now and go on to maybe the threats that they are an indicator species.
Yeah.
Hugely an indicator species of what's going on with climate and habitat change and what have you.
So we will move in. And this is actually a nice episode in the sense that we've got we have the normal decline and threats, but we also have some good news as well, although some of that good news is perhaps an indicator of future bad news. But we'll start with the decline and then we'll move on to the good stuff. So it's definitely going to be an episode where we talk a lot about the normal factors, the normal threats that impact all sorts of animals. They would have popped up in a lot of our species-specific episodes. But like you say, one of the things that's really crucial about dragonflies and damselflies is that the presence of them is a real indicator of habitat health, especially around freshwater.
Freshwater ecosystems, definitely.
Because as we've said, the nymph stage lives in water and they're going to need healthy freshwater habitats, especially full of other insect larvae and tadpoles and all the things that they like to eat. So if you've got a healthy population of even like adult dragonflies and damselflies, which therefore must have come from a healthy population of the nymphs, you know that the freshwater habitat must be full of good food sources. It's that typical thing where if you can see the presence of a predator, it means the rest of the food chain is doing quite well, and being such a prominent predator in the water, they are really, really quite important. And so obviously they have then really suffered as the habitat quality has declined or just outright disappeared in many cases.
Yeah, and it can be something as simple as, you know, 50 years ago there was twice as many ponds in Britain as there are today. And even that has had a huge effect on populations of not just dragonflies, but all, you know,
freshwater animals
and invertebrates that inhabit that sort of freshwater environment. The draining of agricultural land, filling in those ponds, pollution have all contributed to the disappearance of all those countryside ponds. Canals have suffered from pollution, especially by chemicals used on farmland draining into water. So, as you said, it's the same
offenders.
The same offenders, the loss of suitable freshwater habitats.
And when you say runoff, when you say pollution, people often forget about things like nutrient pollution, which then we've said before causes those big algal blooms, and it reduces the oxygen available in the water, which then just impacts all of the freshwater life, including the dragonflies and damsflies. So it's their prey as well as themselves.
Of course, you can talk about this quite well. Yeah, well, this is the one that's part of your day-to-day job, isn't it?
This is the one that's most relevant to my work. The species that are facing particular difficulty, and again, we've done episodes on this, are the peat bog specialists. Yeah. As we lose our peatlands and our, you know, sphagnum moss is disappearing, and sphagnum moss is a really crucial habitat for breeding for some of these peat bog specialist dragonflies and damselflies. So the loss of things like sphagnum has had a huge impact on them. The other one, which again always comes up, is climate change. We get warmer and drier summers, dries out a lot of these pools that they really rely on for breeding. So, you know, old reliable habitats that they've come back to are suddenly not surviving, which also, you know, as these pools, which perhaps have been there for years and years and years, dry up for the first time, we're then losing a lot of the larval stages. The other one, which I sort of forgot about, is the introduction of fish for fish stocking. So formerly fish-free areas of water have then obviously had fish put in so that they can essentially be farmed, and then they are big predators of dragonfly larvae. So if you've got an area that's full of nymphs and then you stick a load of fish in there that where fish haven't been before, especially if the habitat doesn't have lots of diverse sort of hiding areas and nice rich, you know, like gravel beds and different plants and things that the larvae can sort of take refuge in, if it's just an open pool, which didn't matter before because there were no large predators, you throw a load of fish in the mix and suddenly
Not necessarily just a decline in those habitats, it's actually the management of them as well, isn't
just
it?
Just the change of use as well. And so we have seen some significant declines. There was a report that came out, and I think it was from the 1970 to 2019, I think was the report, and it was like a state of nature sort of examination. And there were sort of three named species that have seen quite noticeable decline. You've got the emerald damselfly, which has seen about a 14% decline. And that's the sort of steepest fall amongst these sort of named species. You've also got the black darter, which is a 12% decline, especially in England. And that's one that's been associated with the drying out of the bog habitats that it really relies on. And the common hawker as well has been listed as seeing quite a significant decline, but without an exact percentage really estimated, just that the records are not coming through quite as frequently. But there has been some good news. And I say good news carefully. So in general, whilst we're seeing a decline in a handful of species, and these named ones in particular, species richness of dragonflies in the UK has actually gone up, because since the 1990s, six new species have arrived in Britain, and a seventh arrived and then didn't do too well. But they're actually almost becoming permanent residents.
And is that because of climate change?
It is because of climate change. So it's one of those things where the...
It sounds like it's good.
So we've gained six new species. 19 species have seen significant increases in their population size since 1996. So some of the species are really...
It's not often we can say that, actually, is it? Because most of our species-specific episodes normally revolve around a decline.
Yeah, well, I guess the other thing is, on that point, though, is often our species-specific episode is a single species, whereas we're looking
true.
At a whole order here.
So it's a little bit
different. But, you know, 19 of our dragonfly and damselfly species have seen significant increases, and we've got these six new species, and quite a lot of our dragonflies and damselflies that have perhaps had restricted areas or regions that they exist in. They're starting to expand and move a bit further into the country, move typically further north, because like you said, a lot of the dragonflies in the world are tropical. So they like the warmer climate, which is typically the more southern parts of the country. We're seeing them expand. So, you know, new species increasing, range expansion, all sounds like really good news for dragonflies. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that dragonflies are able to react quite quickly to changes. You know, they're highly mobile. They're more readily able to adapt than, like when we've spoken about spiders, for example, they can't just appear north quite as quickly as an insect that can fly. But the speed at which these species are arriving, the speed at which they're expanding their region, I think should really be taken as a bit of a further warning about how rapidly our climate is changing. Yeah. And okay, the dragonflies may be able to adapt, but a lot of the species won't. And again, especially if they're starting to move into regions that haven't had a high presence of dragonflies, you don't know what impact that will then have on the freshwater ecology of the population there that's not used to being predated on by however many species of dragonflies. Suddenly you've got five more species with healthy populations. The other, or everything they predate on, may then suffer as a result of it.
But yeah, because again, we've talked about that potential imbalance.
Yeah.
It creates an imbalance in some respects, doesn't it?
Yeah, especially, I mean, I haven't looked too deeply on which species are moving where and whether they're hitting regions that see very low numbers of dragonflies historically. But if that was the case and you've got freshwater habitat with loads of other invertebrates that haven't really had to deal with that level of predation, and let's face it, every time we talk about any insect or any species, they're all fighting for survival at the moment. So it only takes a small upset to really disrupt
it. But it is surely an indication of how quickly climate change is having an effect. And there, as I said at the start of this, they're a real indicator species in that respect, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because that tells you that things are moving much faster than we probably would have imagined.
So it's one that I don't think you should ever take the fact that we've got 19 dragonfly species increasing in numbers as a categorically bad thing, because all the time we're looking at species declining. And none of our species are absolutely thriving. So the fact that they're doing well is always a good thing. But it should also be an indicator that our climate is changing rapidly, and that's why these species are able to move further, colonize new regions. And lovely that we've got six new species to go and find, but why have those six new species suddenly able to come over and survive? And it is just a sign of our changing climate. But in general, well, how many species did I say? We've got something like 46 species. We've seen 19 increase. Five experience significant decreasing, and then the others are sort of up and down. So they're all still having to fight with these changing land use, loss of wetlands. And again, before we move on to the nice restoration things, it will hit different species in different ways. As I said, the peat bog specialists, those that have a real niche that they occupy, rather than just a general predator that can sort of inhabit any fresh water ecosystem, they will be fine. But those real niche specialist species will struggle. They will not be as adaptable. So our peatland specialists are struggling and things like that. So it's difficult to be too positive about it when you know that as a blanket statement, they're still having to fight quite a lot of issues.
Yeah.
But as always, lots of fantastic work being done by brilliant organizations to help our dragonflies. And the species that really sparked my desire to do this episode in the first place is the white-faced darter, which is a peatland specialist, and so therefore has seen, you know, quite a lot of decline and a real struggle. And it's a really rare dragonfly, but there's a fantastic project going on to give it some help.
Yes, well, you carry on, because you've probably got more info on that than me. Well, that's run by the RSPB, is it?
It is, yeah. Yes,
it was. That's not in conjunction with the British Dragonfly Society?
Yeah, the BDS, yeah.
Do you know what? I got so into reading the British Dragonfly Society that I'm now officially a member.
Oh, are you? Of course you are.
I joined because, honestly, their whole directive is just trying to restore wetlands and habitats for dragonflies, and it was such a good sight, and so many good projects going on. And I just saw this membership, and I thought, oh, go on then. It was like £25 for the year to be a dragonfly. I get a little pack and a car sticker and everything.
Oh, another car sticker.
Another car sticker. It was worth it just for that. So I get sucked into these things and go, oh, do you know, it's only 25 quid. Oh, I've got to do that. So I'm now officially a member of the British Dragonfly Society.
Well, it was worth doing this episode just for that reason.
Absolutely.
The BDS, their website is brilliant, especially for if you want to ID a dragonfly or damselfly that you've spotted. Their ID guide and tool that they have on their website is brilliant. You can filter it by, oh, where did you see it? In a wetland. Well, all that sort of stuff. Yeah. So
you can volunteer as well. You can volunteer, yes, to, as you say, to go spotting and all sorts of stuff. It's brilliant.
But yes, so the White-Faced Darter Project is up in Cheshire, and it's essentially a reintroduction from donor bogs after some habitat restoration, mainly by like Cheshire Wildlife Trust, the Forestry Commission, BDS and Natural England. But the reintroduction or translocation has been led by the RSPB and the BDS, as well as people like Cumbria Wildlife Trust, all sorts. So it's a real collaborative project. So this species has declined, like I said, their bog or peatland specialist, so habitat loss. And they're sort of only found in very few locations. And so for this project, they've taken larvae from stable donor populations in Campfield Marsh. They've done lots of habitat restoration to create the ideal conditions for the dragonfly to survive and thrive in. And then they've brought over these larvae. And so far, the population seems to be doing really well. They've actually doing another one over in Campfield Marsh. This first one that I mentioned was in Delamere Forest, I think that's how you say that. And so they've done another one, and they've reintroduced larvae into a restored bog in this year, in 2025, with the hope that the adults will then emerge next year. And Brilliant. So it's fantastic to see that they're expanding this project, doing it in multiple places and trying to create the habitat they need. And again, we say it all the time with these restoration projects, they've gone specifically with the goal of we need to help our white-faced darters, but restoring the peatlands is going to be hugely beneficial for everything, for
the whole biodiversity that surrounds a peatland bog. And
so I think it's always important to recognise that a lot of these projects, they'll have a poster boy, they'll have the species that they're really trying to save, but the knock-on effects and the overall impact is huge for the birds, for the rest of the invertebrate, for the freshwater ecology. So it's always fantastic to see, especially with peatlands.
I mean, the BDS is great. They have these dragonfly hotspots the projects that they've created, particularly up in Scotland. It was launched in Scotland in 2014, the Dragonfly Hotspot Project. And the whole thing was to maintain and enhance wetlands habitats to help the dragonflies. They've now got 10 thriving hotspot sites across the country. They work with site managers to maintain and enhance those sites. There are volunteering opportunities so everyone can get involved to help keep the habitat in great condition. And they're now hoping to replicate this success across England and Wales. They've got funding from various foundations to do that. And it's absolutely brilliant. And I would, I think I might say this in every episode now, I would urge you to go onto the site. And again, you can just donate a fiver or do something. And I don't work for them, but I just think these people are, you know, every few pounds from people just helps so much to run these projects. And you know, we're in a world now where we just see all of our habitat and our countryside and our wildlife depleting and declining and under threat and under pressure, and it really is up to us. I think it is. It really is up to us to help in every way we can. We can sit there and watch Spring Watch and moan about things, but unless you actually take some action, however big or small it is, it is so important. And that's why I get sucked in, and that's why I think, oh, it's 25 quid. I know not everyone can afford 25 quid, but you know, most people can afford a couple of quid.
I'll also say, in general, like you've said about volunteering opportunities, they have a lot of information.
Just that as well. Yeah, sorry, yeah. I cut across you, sorry.
They have a lot of information on their website on how to submit records and stuff. So if you actually just want to get out and spot them, they've got loads of information on how to get involved in that. And then you get to spend a lovely day outside spotting stunning insects and still contributing to their restoration efforts and things like that. So it's not always the monetary help. You can also give a bit of time.
Well, time for habitat restoration, and you know, they always need volunteers. You're absolutely right. It's not all monetary. It's just helping where you can to try and protect our, you know, our biodiversity.
I love the fact that every little group of animals has an organisation who are passionate. So you've got the Bat Trust, you've got the Bumble. Actually, talking of help, this is a sideline, but I think important to mention, the Bumblebee Conservation Trust at the moment are really struggling, and they do fantastic work. And they've they've put out a load of information about having to raise money, otherwise they'll have to sort of shut down. So if you also want to give some more insect love, the Bumblebee Conservation Trust at the moment really needs help.
I love a bumblebee.
But back to dragonflies. The restoration projects are fantastic. The one that I really like is the Yorkshire Peat Partnership, known as Dragons in the Dales. And I think I've mentioned this in one of our other episodes, just because I love the name Dragons in the Dales, because what a cracking...
Might have been one of our good news
episodes. Probably. Yeah. And I won't go into it because I have mentioned it before, but it's essentially just a partnership that does habitat assessments for potential reintroductions, especially for those peat bog dragonflies, including the white-faced darter as well. And then there's just national efforts by a lot of the wildlife trusts, the RSPB, the Dragonfly Society, who are just restoring habitat wherever they can with the goal of trying to save our odonates.
Yeah, and WWT also very active for obvious reasons. They're wetlands, wetland centres, wetland areas. They've got some projects. I don't know how to pronounce this one. WWT Caerlaverock. I don't know where it is. It sounds Welsh. I should have looked at that, shouldn't I? But they're doing a huge amount of habitat restoration across their reserve, clearing out ponds every year to prevent them becoming choked with vegetation, creating a variety of habitats, establishing new ponds, rainwater gardens, mini wetlands around the visitor centre. They're doing a huge amount. And actually, WWT... from 21st of June to mid-September have been doing a dragonfly festival. So all of their wetland centres at the moment, you'll see them celebrating dragonflies in what they call the Dragonfly Festival. And it's all summer long. And you can take the kids in there. There's loads and loads of experiences and things to experience in there, all about dragonflies. So that's across all of their 10 wetland centres across the country. So if there's one near
you... It's almost like we time this perfectly.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that goes through to mid-September. Every visitor, it says here, to wetland sites will be transported to the fascinating world of dragonflies.
Well, I will say, things like pond dipping and finding dragonfly and damselfly larva or nymphs and things like that played a key part in my fascination.
Your mum took you pond dipping a lot, didn't
she? Yeah, and it did play a big part in my interest in insects and the natural world and why I then went on to study it and stuff. So I always am a big advocate for getting kids doing insect surveys, but going to find bugs and stuff in the garden and pond dipping, because, I don't know, there's something really quite... Well, we said they're very old, prehistoric and mighty looking about a dragonfly nymph. And so they're a fascinating thing. Every kid wants to see a dragon. Go see a dragonfly. I will also say the other really big thing, we've spoken about ways you can help get involved in volunteering or donations. We go back to our very first episode, stick a pond in your garden.
Absolutely.
Even if it's not a dug-in pond, it's a above ground whiskey barrel one like yours. Yeah. Any sort of freshwater pool is a huge benefit to obviously not only dragonflies, damselflies, but all sorts of insects. But if you want to do something to help and create a nice wildlife spot in your garden, whack a pond in there, and that's a huge impact.
Well, so, less than an hour ago, I got damselflies all over my little pond, which is actually, I've got a whiskey barrel pond, which is raised up from the ground. And then I put another one in, much smaller, and it was on that one. It's only been in a couple of months and I've got damselflies.
Yeah, so another lovely way. And again, you mentioned obviously mum doing pond dipping. We did a lot of insect stuff in the garden growing up, and it played a huge role in my interest. So another lovely activity to do with the kids is get a pond in the garden.
And, you know, also they used to be in school grounds all the time, and that seems to have stopped. And in fact, that might be a little episode we're going to be thinking about doing, isn't it?
Yeah, so stay tuned for that.
Stay tuned for that. So yeah, stick a garden pond. It can just be a small one. I've only got two small ponds and I've got damselflies. Yeah. So
plenty you can do to
plenty
help.
Plenty you can do.
Are incredible.
I don't have too many more.
No, I think I'm good to wrap up.
Conservations. I think that might be it.
Yeah, so hopefully you've enjoyed. They are one of my favourite groups of insects. They are stunning. We've still got enough of summer left to go out and have a little look and spot some beautiful dragonflies.
If you want to see some really good macro shots of dragonflies, go to a Bug in the Lens Instagram page.
Yeah, I'll better post a few more before we make that promise.
I'm sure someone,
there are a few.
Tell
over
me
there.
There's someone there.
There are some, but there's not a huge amount.
Right.
But there are some.
If you want to see a few,
head over to A Bug in the Lens. Yeah.
Great shots of dragonflies.
Of course, we should have mentioned they're on our logo.
Well, of course they are.
So it could talk about cultural impact.
Of course they are.
They're on the Birdie Bug
Pod. I designed the logo, but there's a kestrel and a dragonfly.
Yeah, so there you go. So hopefully you've enjoyed the episode. We've done a bird one, we've done a bug one. It's nice to be back on a routine schedule. We're hopefully got a guest episode coming for you very soon.
I'm really hoping so, because I'm so looking forward to that guest.
So keep an eye out for our next guest episode. Yeah. Normal social media things, did it at the start, but go over and have a look at that's our one. The Birdie Bug Pod over on Instagram to keep up to date with the episodes. We've got a few new things hopefully coming out when I find time to edit them.
Keep an eye out for the merch.
Yeah, if you want a t-shirt.
I'm not expecting you to buy merch, honestly, but... we may be wearing some.
Yeah. But otherwise, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Yeah, really enjoyed that one. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.